And it had its independence in that sense, but then the British took over before that. But ultimately, the situation of the Muslim Ummah was that it was completely defeatist at that time. It rejected the colonialism. It felt a sense of despair. It felt enslaved. It felt like ultimately its dignity had been stripped away from it, right? It wanted to do something about it. It wanted to create change. And so it was an unfortunate state of affairs, but then this shows you the importance of the emergence of a man like Hassan al-Banna and the movement of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it's defined as essentially the first movement of its kind. It's defined as the mother of all of the Islamist movements that emerged since then. So someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna, he felt the responsibility of Islam on his shoulders. He believed that Islam can really provide a solution to all the problems, and that actually the Quran is the constitution that should be ruling in society. So that was kind of the ideology that he had, especially when we're talking about an occupation. We're talking about British and French occupation that was unwanted, that was essentially rejected by the people, that was inherently violent. So someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna sought to mobilise the Ummah. Now, the Muslim Ummah, the seeds of Islam was strong within the Ummah, but it didn't per se have a level of awareness. It didn't have a level of insight, a level of direction. So it really kind of needed that direction. So someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna and the party that he created came on board, and it began to develop political, social and cultural institutions within the society that could really focus on removing those elements of hopelessness and infusing the Islamic spirit, bringing about action and getting rid of that defeatist mentality. So some of the practical actions that someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna took was he got involved in national action from day one. You know, so he mass mobilized protests, you know, on the streets against the colonial rule, demonstrations. He set up the Muslim Youth Association in 1927, which by their own admission is basically looking to promote morality in society, to enjoying good and forbid evil, which is a very important tenet within the Islamic faith. And actually, that was the seed that led to the formation of the Brotherhood the year later in 1928. And in 1933, I believe you had the Muslim Sisters version of the Brotherhood organization. And also a key feature of the Brotherhood was also to bring about this kind of ideological revolution in society. So they had their own newspapers. The first article that they published was called Salt al-Dawah, you know, the call to Dawah. Mm-hmm. Ad-Dawah ila Allah. Yes, it was the call to Dawah. That was the name of the first article that they published in Al-Fatah newspaper. And in fact, the last article that they published, I believe, was in 1947 in the Daily Ikhwan newspaper. So they had their own newspaper that they would publish in every single day. And that was the last works of Shahid Hassan al-Banna. And the article was titled Between Resilience and Tribulations. And that was a month, actually, before the party itself was dissolved by the British-backed monarchy, and 1 year before, you know, Shahid Hassan al-Banna himself was assassinated.
Sure. And, of course, he has been a hugely inspiring figure to other people, Dr. Muhammad. But how about the man himself, Hassan al-Banna? Who were the influences that inspired him in his life and works?
Well, I've heard some in that time was Aziz al-Masri, but he wasn't really influenced by him. He was rather influenced by the Sharia. He was a very clever person. He was qualified in Sharia, and he was memorizing the Quran, and his life was completely surrounded by Sharia. And he find the way, the only way to change the situation in Egypt to the better is by try to follow Sharia. But again, to follow Sharia, you need some close circle. From those close circle, we convey the Sharia rules and this close member to convey it to the rest of the society. And once the society understands the Sharia rule and try to practice it, all the problem was solved. This is what his opinion, and this is what he started from.
Fascinating to hear that perspective there, Doctor. Now, of course, as we've been discussing, Hassan al-Banna's greatest legacy was the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood. We look deeper now into the history of the movement, its achievements, and the mark it's left on the world.
The Muslim Brotherhood was established in 1928 as a reaction to the fall of the Ottoman Empire, British colonial rule of Ottoman territory, and the looming occupation of Palestine, considered the second holiest land in the world to Muslims. Sensitivities towards British colonial rule crystallized in the form of an Islamic political movement. Concerned with the well-being of his nation, who has been left neglected and exploited by the British occupiers, Hassan al-Banna, Islamic scholar and schoolteacher, spread the ideas of a pan-Islamic, faith-based social movement. At its core, it looked after the vulnerable in society by providing much-needed social services like educational programs that taught the illiterate, setting up hospitals and businesses, and aimed to end British colonial reign and, in its place, establish a state run by Sharia law. Although he did not have the resources to make this a reality, it was an idea that enveloped him. Through grassroots activism, he organized local groups and began rallying support for a new movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. The radical ideals of making the Quran the country's constitution spread like wildfire across Egypt. This was made possible by the pre-existing, deeply rooted Islamic faith and practices of the Egyptian people. As the Brotherhood spread rapidly throughout Sudan, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and North Africa in Egypt, the movement launched protests against the ruling Waft Party. An armed element of the group took to more violent acts, including bombing and political assassination, to achieve their aims, which by this stage had deviated from its founder's will. Hassan al-Banna was assassinated 20 years after the formation of the party in 1949, and soon after, the Brotherhood retreated underground due to governmental crackdowns. Six of its leaders were tried and executed for treason, and many others were imprisoned. In the 1960s and 70s, the Brotherhood's activities remained largely clandestine. However, the organization officially renounced violence. In the 1980s, the Muslim Brotherhood experienced a renewal as part of the general upsurge of religious activity in Islamic countries, most notably as a result of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. With Hosni Mubarak forced to step down as president in 2011, the way was cleared for the Muslim Brotherhood's open participation in Egyptian politics, and they were finally elected as Egypt's government. Sadly, this was short-lived. With the coup of 2013, leading members of the Brotherhood were imprisoned, vilified, suppressed, and supporters even sentenced to death. Later that year, the Muslim Brotherhood was officially designated a terrorist organization in Egypt. Despite the crackdowns, the Muslim Brotherhood cannot be erased from the history of the region and remain relevant in their most active offshoot group, Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyah in Palestine, most commonly known as Hamas.
Now, Dr. Mohammed, if we can pick it up with yourself, what sort of opposition did al-Banna face, particularly from authorities in his native Egypt?
Well, to cut the story short, it's always dictatorship doesn't like people to influence the political situation. Dictatorship built a situation which he, the only person can conduct the policies and make the most beneficial of the social and economic system. And that he was influenced by that. And that itself, the dictatorship, never benefit any society. They lead society in order for the dictator to use the sources or resources of the country to make the rest of the country sleep deep in ignorance. And by that time, Egypt was completely, or not completely, huge percentage was ignorance, in particular in religious. Although there was Azhar, and where there's a lot of people memorizing the Quran, but the spirit inside them was very weak to follow the Sharia rules. And Hassan al-Banna had that energy on him to renew what is being left in Egyptian society to follow Sharia rules. And that was considered by the dictatorship a movement against him. That was the struggle between anybody at that time looking to solve any problem of the Egyptian society and the dictatorship. And that was the struggle between the system at that time and Hassan al-Banna and his movement and his follower.
Now, Betul, I'd like to return back to yourself and see the influence that Hassan al-Banna had on other movements across the Islamic world. In particular, we can look, for example, at the Islamic Revolution in Iran and many of the senior figures within that revolution crediting Banna for some of the ideological or philosophical inspirations with regards to their own successes.
Right, so if we're talking in terms of influence, the first notable point to make is first, Egypt as a country, right? So Egypt is a large country. It's got a large population. Egypt was one of those entities that actually wasn't carved up under Sykes-Picot, so it wasn't inherently under Ottoman rule at that period of time. If you look at the country, it also has like the real components of a country. You know, we're talking about legacy, we're talking about civilization, we're talking about history. You know, when someone thinks of Egypt, they think of a center of education, they think of Al-Azhar, they think of literature, you know, they think of humanities. You know, you think of those great Arab and, you know, Muslim intellectuals, a lot of them come from Egypt. So if you were to compare that with some of the other countries in the region, especially those that came out of the Ottoman Empire and then into British colonial and French rule, they didn't necessarily carry that same weight and that same influence. And so nor would you expect a kind of party of this kind or a kind of movement of that kind to emerge from that. You know, for example, if you consider a country like Lebanon, you know, it was like a baby, it was newly formed, it was literally carved out of Syria, for example. So naturally you'd expect Egypt to have that influence on the surrounding region. And the way I would characterize Egypt, it was like almost like that center of gravity in the region. So that was expected. But ultimately, and the reality as it transpired was that they weren't able to bring about this substantial change of shifting the status quo and getting rid of the British-backed monarchy, because it's not just a wish that you have in mind, right? When we look at political action and bringing about a kind of revolutionary substantial change, that requires understanding in depth the conditions of society. That recognizes it's almost like a political science of its kind. You know, you're not going to get that through reading Islamic literature, for example. That is a science of its own. And so you have to understand the conditions of society and how you can apply Islam to that directly. So the way that I would characterize a movement like Ikhwan al-Muslimin, like the Muslim Brotherhood, is they took the reformist approach rather than the transformist approach. You know, so they focused on the partial issues. They focused on let's correcting behaviors in society. Let's focus on correcting norms or rules or ideas, for example. So we should you know, open up charities, for example. We should support those who are impoverished, or we should, you know, shut down centres or pubs where they sell alcohol, for example, or nightclubs, for instance. This was the kind of trajectory that they were going in. Whereas if you look at an entity like the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's an example of one that took about a transformative approach. It's this idea that we have to completely shift the unjust status quo on the ground. This constitution, this Western-backed monarchy that was put in this position of power, and its secular constitution needs to be removed. We need to be governed, and we need to live under the rules of Sharia, of course. And this was something that was only achieved through the people. It was like the masses called for that change, and the people were the vehicle through which Imam Khomeini managed to establish the Islamic Revolution, which is a crucial point. So here we want to make a distinction between what like the ideological thinking of the Muslim Brotherhood was and its direction and its trajectory versus on the ground what it was able to achieve. Now, when we go to about 1948, this was a very sensitive and pivotal moment in history as well. So the first pivotal moment, we said, was the end of World War I, the demise of the Ottoman Empire, British colonial colonial and French colonial rule ascending. And then the second most pivotal point is basically at the end of World War II, where you have the British colonial yoke that is essentially rescinding, and you have America rising onto the helm of leadership, and America actually supporting the liberation movements on the ground, because you had this struggle and this conflict for that next decade between Britain and primarily Britain, and America vying for power in that region and that transfer of power. So, for example, in a country like Iraq, you saw how, you know, Malik Faisal was deposed and you had the revolution of Abdul Karim Qasim. Likewise, in Egypt, you had Malik Farouk, who was deposed, and you had someone like Jamal Abdel Nasser rising to power. So the establishment of this kind of secular republic. And if we analyze a movement like the Brotherhood, it was spreading throughout the region. You had similar organizations that were being formed that had the same weight, essentially, as the Muslim Brotherhood in countries like Iraq, in Jordan, for example, in Syria, its branches, essentially. Although the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood was such that it was more decentralized than centralized. Yeah. So in countries like Iraq, they had more of a kind of independence as opposed to directly having to answer the Egyptian leadership. Yeah.
And I think something that's interesting here as well is, you know, you've mentioned, for example, the Iranians, Imam Khomeini, and one thing he's always focused on has been unity between Muslims. And if we can just very quickly, we don't have a lot of time on the show, but discuss what Muslims can maybe learn from Hassan al-Banna and his approach about how Muslims should unite against a common enemy, in particular when you see what's happening to our brothers and sisters in Palestine at the moment.
Absolutely. So there were three key themes that Shahid Hassan al-Banna focused on, specifically when it comes to the Palestinian struggle for liberation. The first was that he centralized the Palestinian cause as ultimately the cause of the Ummah. You know, this idea that don't think of Palestine as a nationalistic cause, as the borders as per constructed by the superpowers themselves and the colonialists. This is an Islamic duty. It's an Islamic responsibility for every single Muslim to consider the burden on their own shoulders. And he made this very clear. The second point was the unconditional support for the Palestinian liberation cause. And he did not distinguish on the basis of anything. You know, this was very, very clear that every single one of those Palestinians fighting for their land, and that constitutes Muslims of all denominations, Christians and Jews, right, the indigenous people of the land, we need to give them our unconditional support. And the third point that he stressed upon is that we need to boycott those entities that are responsible, essentially, for sponsoring the Israeli occupation entity. Now, it's very important that we mention that Shahid Hassan al-Banna established this party in the 20s. So we're talking about prior 1948, you know. We're talking about when the Balfour Declaration was the kind of baseline, so to speak. And he emphasized that, you know, this Zionist project is a project that's just not limited to Palestine. You know, by their own admission, it's from the Nile to the Euphrates. Every single one of the Arabs has to see it as an existential threat and issue, exactly, because the idea is that they want to expand this beyond, and it's inherently expansionist. Yeah. So if I can just quote one of Shahid Hassan al-Banna's quotes regarding Palestine. He says in 1939, the blood that stained the land of Palestine, the thousands of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of the highest Islamic ideal, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the sanctity of which was violated, all of these call upon you, O Muslim brother and sister, to sacrifice for the sake of God the soul and money he gave you, so that you may be worthy of the name of Islam, essentially. Yeah, so this is no different to what the Islamic Republic is calling today.
What the Islamic Republic is calling for, what other movements are calling for, and how relevant it is today 100%. In 2024, that we see the exact same or even worse oppression happening, and Muslims should be responding to this call. Sister Batul, thank you again so much, as always, for joining us, and Dr. Muhammad as well. And thank you to you at home. We hope that you will join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا Date February 8, 1983. Subject: Importance of Cohesion of the Air Force with Islam, Divine Favors in the Victories of the Nation of Iran. At the court of the Blessed and Almighty Allah, you are held high and are valued for smashing this barrier at a difficult time, and following you, the rest of the armed forces also joined with the nation, so that thank Allah this victory was achieved and the evil Taghut was transformed into the compassionate. You who at the time were serving the evil Taghut are from that day onwards in the service of Islam and in the service of the Blessed and Almighty Allah. The victory that was attained for you and the armed forces from the beginning of the revolution until now cannot be regarded as an ordinary feat. You know what a power we were confronted with at the start of the revolution, a power that was armed in the course of long years, although they had not armed it for Iran, but had armed it to confront the enemies of America, and you know that all the powers were backing it and were aiding it.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. On the subject of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "As long as America has not gone away and the hands of these superpowers have not been taken off our country, our movement shall continue, and so shall our cries, and we shall continue our task, and God willing, we shall succeed." Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, in this viewpoint, is addressing the issue of imperialism and the way Islamic revolution in Iran rejected it. You know, on the national level, the revolution in Iran brought together Iranians of all backgrounds to collectively oppose the Pahlavi regime and its American enablers, which rendered the Shah's military strength and the US backing especially irrelevant. It is a brilliant example of indigenous popular will triumphing over imperialism. On a global level, the revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism resonated deeply outside of Iran and served as an arguably modular approach for other societies to emulate in their quest for justice, dignity, and independence as well. The Islamic revolution challenged the conventional wisdom regarding revolutionary movements, which maintained that religion was not an important or critical factor in modern political struggle. The neither East nor West stance of the Islamic Republic also challenged the Cold War era nation that were only two recognized and acceptable political blocs, and powerfully illustrated how a non-aligned nation could chart its own political and social destiny while maintaining its rights. Moreover, the elimination of the United States' presence in Iran and constant meddling in Iran international politics marked a new era of anti-imperialism, anti-colonialist revolutionary activism, which drew direct inspiration from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and the Iranian people.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, la ilaha illa Allah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of Chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, let's listen to the first to third verses of the chapter.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
تِلْكَ آيَاتُ الْقُرْآنِ وَكِتَابٍ مُبِينٍ
Seen. These are the verses of the Quran and a clear book. As guidance and good tidings for the believers. Who establish prayer and give zakah. And of the hereafter, they are certain in faith.
Now, regarding these verses, we discussed the terminology used in these verses. We discussed the word zakat, also the word mubin, that is both transitive and intransitive, and also the application of the word tilka in the verse, which states and denotes the greatness of these heavenly verses. And because the word mubin is used for the Quran, it means that it's emphasizing and indicating that Quran is both clear and making things clear. So, in the second noble verse, as we said, there are other qualities mentioned for the Quran. هُدًى وَبُشْرَى لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ, a guidance and glad tidings. But the point is that these two actually qualities of the Qur'an are not for everyone. They are for the believers, هُدًى وَبُشْرَى, but not for all the people, for mu'mineen, the Qur'an says. So this means that these mu'mineen, who are believers in the Almighty Allah and hereafter, have their belief firm in the origin and resurrection. Their link with Almighty Allah is strong. So therefore, these qualities point to both their complete faith and their practical inclusive program. Now, there may arise a question here that if these believers have chosen a straight path from the point of basic doctrines and practice value, and both actually, why is it necessary that Quran comes for their guidance? Aren't they already in the right path? Haven't they chosen monotheism? Haven't they chosen Almighty Allah and His side? Now, to answer this, we need to pay attention to one point regarding to the fact that guidance consists of different stages, each of which is a preparation for the higher stage and higher stages. Actually, the answer of this question is made clear. And moreover, the continuation of this guidance is itself another important matter which needs to be discussed in its place.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, dear listeners, since these are mu'minun, it doesn't necessarily mean that they do not need the Holy Quran and its guidance. They do need the guidance of the Holy Quran, even if they are mu'min. Why? Because they need to complete and they need to get their utmost perfection. They have the ability, they have the capacity of reaching that highest levels of perfection. And Quran is there for this. So, it is the same thing that by saying, اِهْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ, guide us, O Lord, unto the right path. In our all daily prayers, we ask Allah that He subhanahu wa ta'ala makes us fix in His way and He continues it. Because without His grace, this continuation, this staying in the right path is impossible. And besides that, taking the advantage of the verses of the Quran and the book manifest is possible only for those who carry the soul of seeking the truth in them. Of course, they might not have obtained the complete guidance yet, but this is the nature of the Quran. It guides people. It guides the ones who have chosen to be in the right path. If we see that in one occurrence, the Quran has been introduced as the origin of piety of the pious. In another occasion, it's been introduced as the source of guidance for the Muslims. And here, as the cause of guidance for the believers, one of its reasons might be that a person will not go after the reality unless at least a stage of piety, submission, and belief in reality exists in his heart. And a disbeliever does not enjoy the light of this manifest book because the eligibility of the place is also conditioned. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
The conversation.
Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we take you, the audience, back to October 12, 1984. In an event that shook the British establishment, a bomb detonated at the Grand Hotel in Brighton, England, killing five people and almost killing then-British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Our next guest was central to this IRA attack. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and Chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Pat McGee. Pat is a former member of the IRA who was jailed for the Brighton bombing in 1984. After serving 15 years, he was released under the Good Friday Agreement. Pat McGee, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
Pat, before we begin, can you tell me a bit about your childhood growing up in Belfast?
Well, at the age of four, I actually left Belfast. The family moved to England. But my best memories of those years were up to the age of four. You know, very solid memories. I'm talking about, I can detail events that happened when I know I was only two. And I think growing up in England, I felt very alienated there. It wasn't a very happy childhood, I have to say that. But I was always thinking about what I'd left behind in my grandfather's house. And I think because I used to go back to it all the time in my head, it firmed up those memories. And they're among the most firm memories I have. And it was a happy time.
So, Pat, what age were you when you came back to Ireland? And, you know, what were those years like, and what motivated you to join the IRA?
Well, the family used to return to Belfast on occasions, and family members from Belfast used to visit us. We were living in a place called Norwich in England. And so I had those links, you know, and they remain quite strong. I first returned onto my own volition, when I was 19, but only for a short while. But it was specifically to see what was happening. I was concerned about what was happening as it was portrayed in the media. You just knew that you weren't getting the full story. This is before events even kicked off properly, as we understand it. But I came back instead at 20. And
what year was that?
That would have been 19, just after internment, so 71.
Okay.
August 71, 15th of August. It was that Sunday, or that Saturday night, yeah. And again, it was that desire just to see what was happening on the ground. Just before, the week before, that whole week taken up by events and over internment, you were getting a feed in the papers, and there were terrible events, and they were getting covered more than perhaps later on the press dealt with these issues. But you still knew that you weren't getting the full account. I had an aunt living in Andytown who had a phone, and I remember talking to her, and she was able to tell me that it was that bad that they had to hide behind the settee. You know, this is a gun battle in the streets in Andytown. So, you know, they weren't covering that in the news. Mm-hmm. And so I came back just to see for myself. And I guess over a period of time, I got to see what was happening, got a better understanding of it. I would have been kind of, for example, I'd known guys, contemporaries, who would have joined the British Army. And at that stage, I would have never have thought of them as Brits or had a bad view of them. But you're hearing all these accounts of what they were doing to people in the streets, you know, the abuse of people. And I couldn't square that with what I knew. Well, you see that for yourself. You're a witness to it. And I saw how people dealt with this occupation. You know, the constant raids. And our house was raided. The messing about in the streets, etc. Just general abuse you felt in your home was occupied. Mm-hmm. And yet that community, it was a Carrickhill community, them days it was Unity Flats, you saw how they coped. And they were all doing it. Everybody seemed to me to be connected. And I just wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be included in that. Didn't know what I could do, what my contribution could be. Really did not know. But I at least wanted to contribute in some way. Eventually that caused me to join the IRA.
When you joined the IRA, what year was that, Pat?
1972.
So the year of Bloody Sunday was the beginning, January 72. And did the likes of Bloody Sunday, was that something that motivated you, or was it what you were seeing on the streets in Belfast?
More the latter. Just an accumulation. I mean, there was no big, you know, event. And that there were many big events, but no, it was an accumulation. What was happening, the daily grind, and seeing how people locally cope with that and wanting to be a part of it.
And of course, just moving on a bit, and we're going to start talking about the Brighton bomb in 1984. Can you tell me a bit about that, how you got involved in that?
Well, during internment, I was interned from 73 to 75. A lot of time to think. And how, again, it's just about what can I do? And I recognised that effectively... best we could do was to target England. Effectively, our actions, you know, with the little resources available to us, would count more there. And I thought, well, I've got a head start here. I was brought up in that. There's a lot of people around me, young lads, but I'm talking about jail, you know, internment. They've never been out of Belfast or never been out of there, you know, where they're from in the country. I had at least that. It seemed to me that put me at some sort of an advantage, you know. And so I came out of internment with a very firm view and commitment to somehow, you know, volunteer to be part of the English campaign. And I suppose the next period was achieving that end. And so, eventually I was active in England. And it was seen as a campaign. Brighton, the Brighton operation, for all of its importance in terms of its targeting, was part of a campaign. We believed that the only way to get the Brits to the negotiating table was for a sustained campaign. Not one operation, no matter how significant, could achieve that. It was about getting a long-term, you know, attack in England. And I think eventually we did that, after a lot of stops and starts, and I wasn't part of that, I was in jail by that stage. We'd have operated in England, withdrew because of logistics involved, and then come back to it. That wasn't a plan, the sort of pressure that was going to be needed. It took us a long time for the movement to gain what was needed. And eventually it did.
Pat, I suppose we know that the people who were operating in England or in Britain at all, there were sometimes greater risks. And certainly the way they were treated after arrest and all the rest was seemed to be pretty brutal. And I'm thinking of people like L. O'Dwyer and Martin Anderson, the Balcombe Street men. You know, there seemed to be a certain level of brutality against Irish prisoners in Britain, and innocent or not, they were all treated really badly, weren't they? What?
It's not quite as straightforward as that, because it was a long campaign, a long history of our people in jail in England. The real harsh days, or the early days, where it was brutal was the norm. Gradually, I think we got on top of it to the point where we were respected by screws and prisoners alike, and you know, we established ourselves. But and you mentioned Ella and Martina, their treatment was atrocious.
Absolutely,
as two women isolated, they've got a harsher, much harsher regime in terms of strip searches, etc., general messing about, than any male prisoner. Never mind whether Republican or otherwise. It was brutal.
So just bringing it back to the Brighton bomb in itself, can you tell me about your role in the Brighton bomb?
No, I can't really, but I don't want to. I don't want to talk about the specifics of the operation. It's just fair to say, like, that I was the person central, you know, he planted the device. But beyond that, I won't comment on it.
And will you tell us about your arrest then and what happened after the bomb?
Well, I was arrested in Glasgow on another operation about 9 months later, and I basically walked into a sort of a trap. Somebody else has been followed. I met them and became, it was in the net, so to speak, and we led them to the rest of the people we were working with. And that's how I was arrested, June 85.
You're still tuned in to The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. Michelle Gildery, my co-host, is here, alongside our special guest, human rights advocate, Pat McGee. You just spoke about your time in prison, and you'd mentioned about Eleanor Warren, Martine Anderson, about the how they'd got it an awful lot worse than the male prisoners. Tell me, what was it like in jail in England? Because I know that you were then moved as part of the circumstance, you were moved to the north. Tell us just a bit more about your own treatment in jail.
Well, once you get through the year on remand and you're so taken up with the upcoming trial that all your thoughts are about that, so you don't really, you know, everything else bounces off even, you know what I mean by that. But then you're transferred, you know, the place you're going to be in for the rest of your life if they have their way. I was put in what's called a special secure unit. These were special units. They've been likened to prisons within prisons because of the security involved. But there would only be, say, seven prisoners, and it would be the same seven prisoners kept there for quite a number of years, very little coming and going. And there would be, everything was isolated from the rest of the prison population, and the screw contingent, they would be specific for the unit. So it's very claustrophobic. You feel isolated, and I think there's good cause to think that we all were damaged by it. I mean that. I felt it myself. There was at times when I verged on a breakdown. I was that close to it. I felt it, you know. But I ended up spending 4 years in two units, so 8 years in total in the units, before our transfer was what they call a transfer. We call it repatriation. A bit of a slip there. before my patriation, our patriation to back home. And our families have been campaigning for that for a long time. This has got to be borne in mind, even though we were there in prison, our whole families and our communities were affected by this. The terrible plight of your loved ones having to get the meagre means together to come across twice a year, say, to see you. We'd have accumulated our visits. We couldn't do it on a weekly basis. But so the pooled their visits and came over about twice a year, school holidays maybe, and at Christmas. So it was really tough on families, you know. I was transferred the day after the ceasefire declaration in 31st of August, 94. Mm. Very next day. In fact, we had won a concession in the jail. We were looking for sort of contact, a coverage, RTE coverage. And we got it. We got RTE coverage. And so we were able to see the declaration and, the cavalcade with the flags out in Belfast. There, it was. We felt part of that. We actually felt part of it. It was a jubilant moment. You know, a corner had been turned. And highly significant. And just after that, and I mean within minutes, a screw came into the room and says, Pat and a couple of others says, get your bags packed. You know, you're going home. Can you imagine how stunning that was? Mm-hmm. And we all celebrated with a sing-song out our cell windows that night, and then the next morning we're huge security transferred to Hull Airport, put on a specially commandeered plane, handcuffed, huge security presence on the plane, brought to Belfast International, the old Aldergrove, transferred a single prison van, all of us, and brought to the prison. You couldn't believe the difference, you know. That.
How many of you were in the van? And
three of us, and then a couple of screws, probably three screws. But it was all very low-key. I mean, as far as we were concerned, you know, we were going home. We were a step nearer home. In terms of the negotiations, we know what was going on. Things were moving ahead. But also that just we were amongst our own. Even though there were screws, mm-hmm. you were hearing Irish accents for the first time, you know, when we were just submerged in all this Englishness. Mm-hmm. You know.
That must have been very special. And when, so the negotiations were going on, when did you sort of feel or hear the first moves of, you know, the settlement and the Good Friday Agreement and the work that was ongoing towards that and the moves towards...
Not so much here as what you know about what was happening in our present state at any given time. Standing in the dock, I knew we were good. Things were going in our direction. So, you know, the political development of Sinn Féin, etc., and the mounted campaign, things were more positive at that moment. And within a year of that, you know, the political developments, and that continued. So it was going to go there, but we still knew we had to kind of knuckle down and get through the sentence. Mm-hmm. I estimated that, this is just me, this is my peculiar way of looking at things, I thought there'd be a focus on a political solution before the new millennium. I thought that would concentrate their minds. We know it happened well before that. Mm-hmm. But that was my time scale of what I thought I had to cope with personally. Yeah. You know, so you're geared to that.
So you were gearing up for the remainder of your sentence here. Mm-hmm. You were amongst your own people. Your family, it was easier for your family to visit. You didn't feel the same sense of isolation. But then you were released under the Good Friday Agreement. So how did that feel? Or?
The run-up to that... we started a veil of the conditions that applied to all the prisoners. We were held under, still held under a Home Office rules, which meant we didn't get the entitlement that other prisoners had to pre-release schemes, etc. Then suddenly, that was conceded to us. And I must have got out like about 100 days or something that was spread out before. So that's kind of a preparation for it. It wasn't sudden, suddenly you're out. I was in, I think it was 12 years and 4 months, and suddenly I'm outside of prison. It's a huge moment, you know. But on the 14th anniversary of my capture, I was released, you know, I was released. So it took place in December 2000.
And Pat, you struck up this extraordinary relationship with Joe Barry, whose father was killed in the Brighton bomb. Do you want to speak a bit about that and how that came about?
Well, I met Joe Barry that first time in November 2000. I thought it was going to be a one-off meeting. I was there, in a sense, wearing a political hat. I would try to explain to Joe, this woman, why we targeted Brighton, to put that operation in a context and hopefully do it with some sensitivity. And that conversation became a conversation, lasted 3 hours. And it was a very incredible and tense experience for both of us, I'm sure. And it was an exchange. I was, again, explaining our motivations and the context of the day. She was telling me things about her own experiences of her father and of the impact of the bomb on her and her family. And she's clearly a very sound, intelligent woman who knew quite a bit about Ireland. In fact, had visited Belfast quite soon, within a couple of years, of her father's death. Wanting to know, I was completely unaware of this. I only got to hear about this, as I said, a matter of months beforehand. But this is something she was committed to achieving long before that, right from the loss of her father. And, you know, like as I'm saying, you're gauging this woman, and at some stage she recited a poem she'd written, and she'd written this sometime between 3 and 6 months before actually meeting me, before we were in this room sitting talking. And there was a phrase in the poem, "Now I stand before you who killed my father." She had actually prefigured the moment, and it was really affecting, you know. And it was like a completely different conversation after that. And as I said, I'm getting some impression of this woman. She's a very fine woman. And then suddenly something just clicked. It's what I perceived in her, knew, must have, in some measure, coming from this man. It had come from him. She was clearly, the loss was apparent. And I killed this guy, you know. In other words, I killed a fine human being. And for me, it changed things. I couldn't articulate this feeling in the moment. But after that first meeting, I had all these thoughts, you know, and tried to put them down on paper too, you know, how to take this forward. I never for a moment thought there would be a second meeting, but I would have jumped at a second meeting. What I didn't appreciate was that Joe wanted the same. She wanted to meet me again. She also had this feeling that was more to be said, more to be explored. And the next meeting occurred 2 weeks later. And we've been meeting quite regularly since then.
Pat, it's been an extraordinary journey. And me and you have become good friends over this last number of years. And it's always good to have you here. I want to thank you, okay? I want to thank Michelle. And you're welcome back anytime. Great to see you again.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Michelle.
This week we take a look at Bloody Sunday and the reverberations that followed for many years after. How has the city of Derry moved on from then, or can it ever fully?